The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Today is the Military History Club. And my name is John. Every month we do this. We've so far covered the key leaders of World War II up until this point. Prior to this, we covered Charles de Gaulle, Winston Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, Adolf Hitler. Today will be Mussolini. Next month will be Japan's dictator, Tojo. Even though Hirohito was the emperor of Japan, and he'll probably be covered partly as well because he worked with Tojo. Tojo was really the war leader of Japan. And then the last month will be Francisco Franco of Spain. And even though he was not technically an Axis leader, he did have troops on the Eastern Front, so we'll cover him as well. Today, since we'll be covering Mussolini, there are a few things that will really stand out that will be very, 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 very interesting for Mussolini. For one, here in America, we don't talk much about during World War II. One of the reasons for this is because we tend to focus on Adolf Hitler in Germany, and we focus on Japan. Italy is kind of seen as a country that was in World War II. Initially, we fought against them, but they were not a major force. For some reason, they are portrayed as that. In reality, that's very, very far from the case. The reason why we don't tend to cover it here in America is because by the time we got in the war, Italy was on its way out of the hostilities. We got attacked on December 7th, 1941. By 1943, Italy was out of the war. So we only spent about a year fighting the Italian army in North Africa. So we don't really do much focusing on it. Since we do cover the war from the various perspectives of the different countries, we'll see a little bit of a different story of the war than what we would normally be used to seeing, because we're going to be looking at it from how it would be portrayed from that viewpoint, and we'll be covering a lot of facts. But before I begin, does anybody need any of these outlines? Just raise your hand and I'll pass them out.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
One.
Is this the same one that you had previously?
No. Last month was that one. Well, this is Mussolini. Do you need one too?
Okay.
Okay. Anyone else? And, of course, we're going to be opening the floor because this is a discussion, not a lecture. I am not doing any lecturing of anybody. But there are a lot of things to consider when it comes to Benito Mussolini as well. First of all, there's a contrast between him versus Adolf Hitler. First, one of the contrasts is that Hitler based a lot of his ideology on myth, on legend. He was a great lover of Wagner. He believed in a previous master race reigning the world. He had a lot of ideas, especially Himmler, Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS as well, had a lot of ideas that were not historically based. And as a result, it affected a lot of his decisions. With Mussolini, it was a little bit different. One of the reasons why is because Mussolini tended to focus more on history as far as the Roman Empire was concerned. The Roman Empire was located in Italy. Mussolini's living in Italy. He wanted to recapture a lot of the glory of the Roman Empire. He wanted Italy to have a second empire. So with him, it wasn't myth. With him, it was very, very much documented reality. Another thing about Mussolini that affected his mindset was what was taking place around the time he was born and just prior to it. Mussolini was named after Benito Juarez, who was a huge revolutionary in Mexico. His father was very, very anti-cleric. And one of the funnier things about Mussolini is that he is born in the late 19th century, 1880s. Well, what happens in Italy prior to 1880? Italy is divided between various different countries. You have two Sicilies here, you have Piedmont, you have the Papal States, Venice is separate, Sardinia is separate. You have several different countries that were in Italy only 30 years prior to his birth. Also, Austria controlled much of Italy at the time. What happened was there was a huge unification drive under Giuseppe Garibaldi. Italy begins to unite roughly around 1859. Napoleon III plays a part in it because he sends troops into Piedmont and he confronts the Austrian army, which is one of the reasons why Nice, which is in this part of France, and Savoy, which is in this part of France, were given over to France because it was given as a reward for what Napoleon did fighting the Austrians. The key, however, to all of this is that there was a huge push for national pride and national unity. So by the time Mussolini is born, this is basically how culture is. He's born into this. Then, of course, in the 1860s, there's another war with Austria. You have the Battle of Lissa, which is between the Italian Royal Navy and the Austrian Royal Navy. And then, by the 1880s, Italy begins to think about rebuilding an empire. So what do? They attack Ethiopia. And the reason why is because Britain and France, for the most part, had huge colonies in Africa. And then you had some smaller ones like Belgium, Portugal, Spain. Italy felt that they could do the same. So they attacked Ethiopia, and all of a sudden, they lose a very cataclysmic battle called the Battle of Alba. The Ethiopian Royal Army smashed the Italian Army at Alba, and it really affected the viewpoint that a lot of Italians at that time had about their country, because other world powers didn't see them as being the same. Mussolini is dealing with this in a detrimental way because around the time of the Battle of Alba, he is very, very, very young. In 1912, Italy goes to war with what was then the Ottoman Empire centered here in what's now Turkey. They take Libya in 1912. They also take the Dinoxides Islands, which are right here, and they begin to form an empire. Also, they also have Italian Somaliland, which is now Somali, which is Italian East Africa. These are the areas that Mussolini had when World War II began. Now, one of the funny things about Mussolini is that he fought in World War I. The viewpoint of World War I in Italy's mind was rather different from most of the other world. Before I even go there, I'm going to ask the crowd a question. How does America view World War I? Because we entered World War I 100 years ago. So how do we view World War I?
Something to stay out of.
Or agree to part. Anybody else?
Well, that the British and the Germans were fighting each other in trenches, and we came along and we finally got into war and managed to win. Mm-hmm. So when you think about the war, at least in my mind, it's just the trenches and more than France.
Mm-hmm. Except for Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything else on how we view World War I? Generally, when it comes to, and this is where a lot of what we will cover will be very, very different from what we will see in other countries. In World War I, America basically says we're going to stay out of the war, we're going to stay out of the war. At the time, Woodrow Wilson is the president.
all of a sudden, the idea comes up, we're going to win the war to make the world safe for democracy. Mm-hmm. A very common phrase we hear now, mm-hmm. like in Iraq or Afghanistan. Well, that came out of World War I. And what ends up happening is that we send troops to the Western Front mostly. There was a small contingent that went to Italy against Austria-Hungary, but most of them were in France. And what ends up happening is the way that we're taught about World War I is that we arrived there, we were called doughboys because we weren't combat ready, and all of a sudden, since there were fresh troops and there were so many fresh American units arriving, we overwhelmed the German trenches and we won the war. Which is spin, because it makes us look good. British don't see it that way, and neither do the French. The British basically see it as this. Their navy blockaded the German navy after Jutland. We crippled the German economy. The German economy fell. The German navy mutinied, and eventually we broke the German army on the front line. So the British tell it quite differently. The French tell it quite differently as well. They had over 10 million men. They faced the biggest sacrifice on the Western Front. They stopped Hindenburg and Ludendorff's final drive in March of 1918. And when they stopped the drive, they took the wind out of their sails. And therefore, France won the war. So everybody tells it different. Italy saw it quite differently as well. Because, and this is very, very important to Mussolini. Because Italy originally had an alliance with Kaiser's Germany, and it had an alliance with Austria-Hungary. The funny thing is, Italy didn't get along with Austria-Hungary, but the reason why they made the alliance is because they wanted more territory in Europe. Remember, they wanted to rebuild an empire. Well, what happens? Germany joins the war, Austria's in the war, and all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, Italy doesn't join. Italy waits till 1915. And then they decide to join the Allies. Mussolini joins the military as well. He's actually an editor, and he joins the military because he wants to take part in the final victory. And the Italian, we won't get into the details of the Italian front because this is about Mussolini and World War II. But the fighting in Italy was very, 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 very fierce. And the Austro-Hungarian army almost drove them out of the war at one point, especially around Caporetto. What saved Italy, however, was that they were able, under General Diaz, to make a drive towards the Austrian army in the northeast region of Italy. And because there was a drive coming out of Salonika, the Austrian army had to face a front here and a front here. General D'Aspre of France breaks through at Belgrade. He's threatening to drive all the way to Budapest. When he's threatening to drive to Budapest, the Hungarian army says, that's it, we're out of here. And they start to go home. And what ends up happening is the Italian front collapses for the Austrians. The Italians break through the enemy lines. Therefore, they're seen as heroes because they knocked Austria out of the war. And right after that, Germany. So they see themselves as being very, very key to the victory. And so does Mussolini. The problem is that they don't get that much territory. They get Trieste, this little piece here, and they wanted a whole lot more. Now, why is this key for Mussolini? Look at the timeline, okay? Libya, 1911-1912. World War I, 1914. World War I ends, 1918. Mussolini gets out of service. He's injured during the war. He shapes his image. Originally, and it's very, very funny, because if you look at photos of Mussolini, you'll see him in these great military uniforms with this hat on. Very early in Mussolini's career, he didn't pattern himself. Patterned himself as a musician,
as a playwright, as a very cultured man, as a family man. Very, very polished. And this won over the Italian population in 1920. Well, guess what? By 1922, he's in charge. He marches on Rome with his black shirts, and he becomes the dictator of Italy. If you could see, the timeline moves quite quickly for him. From 1912, they get Libya. 1914, they're at war. 1915, they declare war with Austria. 1918, they break through the lines. They win the war in Austria. By 1922, only 4 years later, he's in charge. So things are moving quite quickly for him. So now, we're starting to get to World War II. That was just the introduction. You can see how the past affected them. You can also see how things began to shape up rather rapidly. And he was very, very polished, very professionally done early in his career. One of the things about Mussolini, which is also very interesting around this period, is the economy wasn't that good. And he was able to highly build up the economy then before World War II.
Can you close that door?
Sure. Let me see if anyone's coming.
Interfering with my hearing.
Are you coming?
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Oh. Away, then seems to be.
Sure. But as I was saying, he was very polished. He worked with to build the economy up in a lot of areas where there were malaria in southern Italy. He was draining the swamps so that people could live healthy lives. I mean, very early in his career, he did quite a bit of good. He made the trains run on time, which some people often joke about, but he made the system work. He made a lot of things work in pretty brutal fashion. But if you weren't affected by that, you're thinking he's a good guy. You know, very deceptive. And we have the benefit of hindsight. But they did. So, 1920s, early 30s, this is what we have. So, before we start getting into the events involving World War II, opening up the floor. Yes?
Is this true that sometime in that period, Mussolini was actually sort of like a father figure? He visited Adolf Hitler, and Hitler was in prison. Isn't that correct?
We're going to get to that. He was a role model to Hitler. Hitler looked up to him. Yep.
Was there a single episode, what was the evidence for Mussolini to capture power in 4 years? Was there a single event?
There were a few things happening at the time. There was the loss of a lot of the soldiers due to World War I. Which was only 4 years earlier. The economy was doing very bad right after World War I. You had that problem. And you also had a lot of people wanting to rectify wrongs. See, Italy in those days was a monarchy. The thing about the monarchy is that the monarchy was not very effective in handling a lot of the economic and social problems of the country. He was promising to do that when the population was very ready for it and rather angry because of it. The king at the time was Victor Emmanuel III. They had quite a bit of problems even before that. Like the previous king, one of the earlier kings around 1900, was assassinated in Milan. And that was only maybe 20 years prior to this. Because the royal government was trying to suppress unrest, and there was a huge demonstration in Milan. He sent out the royal army and they started shooting at the crowd. Many elderly people were killed, many ladies were killed. And as a result, the king comes to Milan, gives his general a medal, and then one of the brothers of one of the ladies who was killed actually kills the king. Shoots him. So you had a lot of unrest, and World War I certainly exacerbated. A lot of unrest. But they did have a very good name.
His politics changed. I see he was the editor of a socialist newspaper.
Originally.
So his politics made a drastic change, or at that point, what?
I wouldn't say it was a drastic change. No, I wouldn't say that. Because, and this is, that's a good point. One of the funny things about where we live at now in 2017, we think socialism is kind of okay in certain circles. We forget Nazism, for example, is national socialism. Fascism has a lot in common with socialism too. So his politics didn't change all that much. No. He crafted himself better. He dressed himself up. He eventually shaved his head bald, you know, because he didn't feel like a receding hairline was very dynamic. You know. But it was very, if anything, I would say he was a very, very, very good opportunist, very good at manipulating, very good at polishing himself, and that won the day for him. And one of the things that Mussolini did that was very, very good as far as how people viewed him was the Lateran Treaty. The Lateran Treaty. He made the treaty with the Roman Catholic Church. I'd say maybe 70 years earlier, much of Italy was owned by the Catholic Church. They called them the Papal States. The Pope actually had political power and military power. What Mussolini did was he realized that during the unification, all of that territory was taken away. Now, before I get into that, it wasn't taken away right away. Italy was united around 1859. They started to take some of the Papal States away. Napoleon III of France prevented it. He actually had French troops stationed in Rome. But he had to pull out because of the Franco-Prussian War in 1871. When he pulled out in 1871, the nationalists took over of the Papal States. There was a lot of dispute as to what to do with the property. And what happened? Mussolini said, okay, I'm going to give you property, and I'm going to give the Pope sovereignty, I'm going to give him a portion of Rome, and I'm going to call it the Vatican. So the Vatican is actually a separate country from the rest of Italy. And it comes from that treaty that Mussolini made. And you're right, he was a role model to Adolf Hitler. Because remember, Mussolini rises to power as early as 1922. Hitler was sitting in jail. He was being oppressed by the Weimar Republic. He doesn't come to power into the late 30s. Well, actually early 30s, around 33. He's around 33, 34. And this actually starts to set up what happens in World War II. And it sets up the contrast between him and Hitler as well. Because if you ever look at Adolf Hitler, what happens when he rises to power is very, 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 very interesting. He becomes chancellor. Paul von Hindenburg, World War I hero, was the president, the head of state of Germany. When Hindenburg dies, Hitler does a power grab. He consolidates the state under his full authority. Okay, that's what Adolf Hitler does. Mussolini can't do that. Because there's a monarchy in place. Victor Emmanuel III is the head of state. So, in some cases, he is in a more vulnerable position than Hitler was with respect to consolidating power. Now, another aspect leading up to the war is what Mussolini does. Mussolini is much more aggressive early on than Adolf Hitler. If you remember, Hitler doesn't really make a move aggressively with his military till 1935. He marches into Rhineland. And then later on, around 37, he goes into Austria. Mussolini actually becomes very, 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 very aggressive early on. What does he do? 1936, he attacks Ethiopia. Pretty much conquers the whole country. Originally, it was a really good military fight, and eventually he used poison gas. Ethiopia, they don't make gas masks in Ethiopia. So the Ethiopian army gets gassed to death. He conquers it, and he calls it Italian East Africa. I should differentiate this because this is territory. So then what does he do? He helps Francisco Franco in Spain. So now you have a aggressive dictator in Europe moving troops around. One of the key generals he sends over there is a general by the name of Rolada. You will hear of him later. General Rolada was very, very brutal. Very brutal. He sent a lot of airmen over there. He sent a lot of tanks over there. And he eventually, his generals actually lose the Battle of Guadalajara during the Spanish Civil War. But it proves the limits of tank warfare. You can't use tanks in the mountains. At that time, they didn't know that. He tried to use tanks in the mountains of Spain during the Civil War. But anyway, Franco becomes a fascist dictator directly because of Mussolini. And it's also very interesting because Franco intended to build a navy very much like Mussolini's. Mussolini had a navy that was mostly World War I battleships. By the 1930s, he modernizes drastically. He starts to build the Roma class. You have the Vittorio Veneto, the Roma, and a fourth ship, which would have been the Imperia. They were pretty state-of-the-art, over 800 feet long, three turrets, three guns per turret, 15-inch guns. Very, very powerful, very, very quick. The thing is that had he had his way, he would have built two for Spain as well. Spain would have basically been a satellite state. Now, Mussolini also invades Albania. Albania is very interesting because originally Albania was very sympathetic to Mussolini. They were allies. And then he turns on his ally and totally takes them over. So now this is directly under his control as well. This is key because he's going to try to take this portion of Europe over, which is what he originally wanted to do. Mussolini, prior to Hitler annexing Austria, wanted to make Austria, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Yugoslavia and Greece client states. He wanted to literally build a Roman Empire that went about like that. And he was well on his way to doing that. Well on his way to doing it. Actually, this map is not quite correct. Because Hungary. But he is well on his way to doing that. One thing that Mussolini also does is by him attacking Ethiopia, he proves that the League of Nations is useless. Totally useless. So you have politicians meeting in Geneva, supposedly trying to meet to stop wars. And what does he do? He marches right into Ethiopia. Emperor Haile Selassie starts yelling and complaining, "Stop Mussolini, he's taking over my country." What does the League of Nations do? Nothing. And that's devastating because just to his north is Adolf Hitler. Hitler watches that. And that plays a direct role in how he deals with Neville Chamberlain in Munich. If Mussolini could get away with it, I'm definitely going to get away with it. And that sets up World War II. So, any questions before we move on to the war? Because I feel like I'm talking too much. I'm talking way too much.
Keep talking.
way too much. But then, now I guess we could get to World War II, I guess. World War II starts on September 1st, 1939. Hitler invades Poland. 2 days later, France and Britain declare war on Nazi Germany. Mussolini doesn't get involved right away because he's not going to, and he's a smart man for doing it because he's thinking, I'm not going to get involved in this conflict and all of a sudden get these guys to attack me. I'm going to make sure I can win this. So he holds out. Mussolini holds out till 1940, till June of 1940. Now, what happens between September of 1939 and June of 1940 is a lot. Hitler conquers Poland along with the Soviet Union. Remember, the Soviet Union was originally allied to Hitler, originally, until 1941-42. Conquers Poland. Then what does Hitler do? Conquers Denmark. Then he conquers Norway. Then he attacks Belgium and the Netherlands and France. He takes Paris. He's now marching to about right here in France. Mussolini realizes, I don't have to worry about the French army. I'm going to go and do this. He basically says it's only going to spend me a few thousand soldiers to sit at the victory's table. He's literally saying this to his foreign minister, Gianni Zaccagno. Yeah. So what does he do? He attacks southeast France. Doesn't get very far. Because prior to World War II, the general thinking was you make fortifications. Concrete border fortifications, and that protects your country. With France, it was the Maginot Line against Germany. But against Italy, there was a smaller Maginot Line that actually held up really well under General Orly. So Mussolini couldn't break that line. In the fighting on the Franco-German border, the French lose about 122 soldiers. Mussolini loses about 4,000. Very lopsided. Very, very lopsided. Because of the surrender, he is able to occupy at least this much territory in France. Mostly as a courtesy. Because his troops didn't earn it. Then Mussolini gets bold. He decides, I'm going to invade Greece. Okay? Germany's marching into Yugoslavia. He marches into what's Croatia, basically. So he takes over this part of the coast. He attacks Greece. His generals tell him, don't do it. Marshal Badaglio tells him, do not do it. We are not equipped for this. Does Mussolini listen? No. So what ends up happening is he attacks Greece. The Greek army literally deal him a very embarrassing defeat. He ends up invading about to here, and then he's pushed back to the border. At one point, the Greek army starts to invade Albania, and they're literally coming into what Mussolini claimed as his own territory. And Hitler begins to basically rescue him, and Romania comes in, Bulgaria comes in, Hungary comes in, Germany comes in, and they invade Greece along with Mussolini's forces, and then Greece is eventually taken. Is anyone familiar with boxing? Has anyone ever heard of Joe Louis?
Yeah, yes.
Do y'all remember who he fought? A guy named Max Schmeling?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Max Schmeling was in the paratroopers for the Germans, and he landed at Crete during this period. He didn't want to fight. He was drafted, from what I remember. But he played a part. You're going to hear a lot of names, probably, that are pretty familiar, that history doesn't normally associate with. Mm-hmm. So now, Mussolini has a pretty good chunk of territory. It's 1940, going toward 1941, but he has a problem. Big, big problem. The British, the Ethiopians, the French are attacking his units in Ethiopia. And by 1941, Italian Somalia is under Allied hands, and Ethiopia is under Allied hands. What Mussolini wanted to occur, just so that you know,
He wanted his armies to come out of Libya and out of Ethiopia to squeeze the British out of North Africa. He never got the chance because he could never win in Ethiopia. Now, to his credit, well, not his credit, but his army's credit, the commander in Ethiopia was the Duke of Arosta, who's from this part of it. Even though their troops were defeated in 1941, elements of the Italian army in Ethiopia held out in guerrilla activity as late as 1943. They did a very good job. A very good job. The British could not cause them to surrender, and they were able to evade a lot of the British army, mostly in the southern and western portion of Ethiopia. So it was not a total loss. They fought very well. And I should say this because it gets into what happens in Libya. Oftentimes, we do not associate the Italian army with fighting very well in World War II. They fought quite well. They fought very well. The worst problem with the Italian army under Mussolini was not the fact that they were not willing to fight. In some cases, it was the fact that their leadership was not bold enough. And in other cases, it was the fact that their equipment was not as good. Many of their early tanks did not have adequate armor to withstand a lot of the armor that was being shot from the British Churchill tanks and so on and so forth, the cruiser tanks that the British had. A lot of their airplanes were also very good, especially their fighter craft. The Italian Air Force had very good fighter craft, but we don't think about that. During the war, what happens, and this is not just World War II, but all wars, the victors write the history books. But they really, really, really did do quite a good job. It's just that they were unfortunate in the fact that sometimes their equipment wasn't that good, sometimes their leadership wasn't that good. So now we're going to get to Libya, Russia, and England. Any contributions to the East Africa campaign with Ethiopia? One thing about the East Africa campaign, usually our history books don't talk about that. They don't talk about that because no American forces fought there. It was over by the time we entered the war. So we don't mention
it. Going back to that, this book was kind of goes to how Italians fought. One of the things that battle did with the poison gas was that people, the Italians fighting for, they turned off, they had the kind of effect of it turned off morally. A lot of Italians who are fighting this war started to say, really have a problem with that when they, just with the poison gas and that mass, a lot of them had problems with that, similar to what, you know, we experienced in Vietnam with the, some of the stuff we did. But it really helped to kind of undermine Italians' fight for it. They just, you know, that humanity just kind of got in the way. That had the opposite effect of sooner or later just kind of turning them off. And
well, that's with the Ethiopian War of 36. Yeah. And that happened. Yeah. Some of the soldiers did not like what Mussolini did. Yeah. He did. Yeah. And it wasn't just Mussolini's army. You don't hear about it with Germany, but you had it. There were a lot of Germans that did not like what Hitler was doing. A lot of Soviet soldiers weren't thrilled with Stalin. To the point where if Stalin made them commit autocracies, they might have done it and then they were killing themselves. Mm-hmm. Had very, very high, in the Soviet army, had a very high degree of suicide. Mm-hmm. Very high degree. Because they couldn't reconcile what he was asking. Mm-hmm. With Germany, sometimes they ended up on drugs. Mm-hmm. They would use drugs, get very high.
But they were giving drugs to the make them do it too. I mean, they were supplied with the drugs. They might have taken them too afterwards because they needed them, but they also were just given them
just
part of their as part of their
the regimen.
The regimen.
The battle.
Yeah, they were doing it. Yeah.
What is autocracy?
Autocracy?
Isn't that what you said about the Soviet?
I think you said atrocity.
Oh, I meant autocracy. Yeah. Like,
basically, crimes against humanity.
Yeah. Atrocity.
Yeah. I thought you said autocracy.
I might have said it wrong.
That's what I heard.
I may have said it wrong. One of the more interesting things also as well. We don't talk about the East Africa campaign, and I could not fit it on this map because the map isn't big enough. But Italian troops did fight in the Battle of Britain as well. Mussolini sent some Air Force regiments, and they were stationed in Belgium, and they were bombing British cities on the East Coast. London, Leeds, and so on and so forth, Dover. They were doing a lot of bombing runs. They weren't too successful.
Why? Was he looking for more support from Hitler to get Yugoslavia into his realm?
That was specifically Mussolini's idea.
Okay.
Mussolini's idea was, I'm going to do exactly for Hitler what Hitler does for me in the Mediterranean. He helps me in Greece, so I'm going to help him fight in Britain. Okay. The problem is that the planes, the bombers that he sent were not adequately armed for defensive capabilities. And it was the machine guns had too small of a caliber, and it had no fighter escorts. So he was flying bombers from Belgium into England facing Spitfires. Faster planes, very, very structurally strong planes, very high casualties. So much so that they were only, I think, in Belgium maybe 8 weeks. Yeah. Because the losses were too horrendous. He had to pull those guys out. It was pretty bad. He ends up sending the same units to fight against the Soviet Union. And even though there were more effective fighter planes that they sent, he sent the same bomber units with the same... And he got the same result, you know, not very good. Specifically in the southern portion of the Soviet Union towards Stalingrad and in Ukraine near Kursk. That's where a lot of the Italian 8th Army was stationed at, and that's where he was sending a lot of his air regiments and air force fighters and bombers and whatever. So that's what you have there with that. We don't hear about. But now you get into 1942. Most of the war that was taking place with Italy that we do hear about is Libya. And, of course, the Italian campaign. Libya. He didn't have to worry so much about the French to the west and to the south because on June the 22nd of 1940, France signs the armistice. So they're not a threat. But the thing is that the British are, and the British are right here. Initially, General Wavell was the British general that was sent. He invades Libya, has a measure of success. The Germans send Rommel in and chases Wavell out. Then Churchill sends General Auchinleck in. Auchinleck comes back into Libya again. Rommel chases him out partway. But then Auchinleck fortifies himself at Tobruk, at the Gazala line. We often hear about Tobruk. The Gazala line was basically shaped like that. Mostly he had British forces, New Zealanders, South Africans here, and then there was a Free French unit under General Koenig here, which Rommel had a hard time with. Very, very, very hard time with.
It's a French unit?
Originally, they sent the Orient Division, one of Mussolini's divisions. This is known as the Battle of Bir Hakeim. Originally, and I don't think I put that in here, but originally, they sent the Orient Division and tank units against
General Koenig's Free French. No success whatsoever. Rommel gets frustrated. So Rommel says, okay, we gotta get through this. Rommel ends up attacking with Stuka dive bombers as well as panzers. No success. That line held at Bir Hakeim for 2 weeks under constant bombardment. The only reason why they eventually fell back was because they ran out of food and the British couldn't supply them. And the British ordered them to come back, and they wouldn't come back. They stayed in the desert fighting for another day or two. And then once they evacuate, Rommel just goes right around the line, folds up the Gazala line, and he takes Tobruk. Eventually, Rommel ends up marching east. And he gets caught in a place called El Alamein. There's a new sheriff in town in charge of the British 8th Army named Montgomery. Now, we often hear about this, but what we don't hear about is what was happening back in Rome. Prior to all of this taking place with El Alamein, there was a lot of problems taking place with Mussolini's high command in Libya. As early as 1939, they were having problems in Libya. Italo Balbo was in charge of the Italian Air Force. The British did a raid on Benghazi. Anti-aircraft starts shooting at the British planes. The Italian fighter crews scramble to engage the British fighters, including their air minister. He decides, I'm going to get in the plane and I'm going to lead my men to battle. Well, there's one problem. His plane gets shot down by his own men. He's one of the early casualties of the high command. Unfortunately, he's not the only one. It's very, very crazy. General Graziani becomes the head of the Italian army in Libya shortly after that. Has anyone heard of General Graziani? Rudolfo Graziani. Has anyone ever heard of Tony Graziani? Who's Tony Graziani? Has anyone ever heard of the Philadelphia Soul?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Arena football?
Yeah. Yeah.
Tony Graziani used to be the quarterback.
Oh.
Until about maybe 5 years ago. That's Marshal Rudolfo Graziani's grandson.
Okay.
So... it's kind of funny. We're talking about Mussolini's chief general and his grandson plays quarterback for us. But this is what we have going on here. Anyway, I'm tempted to call him Tony Graziani now. Rudolfo Graziani is the marshal. He's the CNC commander-in-chief in Libya. Okay. General Torelli is in charge of ground troops. I believe it was the Italian 10th Army, if I'm not mistaken. Memory serves me right, was the 10th. He gets killed in battle when General Wavell is fighting in the first invasion. Originally, when he gets killed in battle, another general by the name of General Italo Garibaldi takes over. Garibaldi is basically the general that throws back General Auchinleck at Tobruk with Rommel. Eventually, Garibaldi comes out and they send another general by the name of Bastia, General Bastia, and I believe his name is Ettore Bastia, if I'm not mistaken. He was a good general, a very, very good general, one of Mussolini's best, and he was actually one of the rare generals that is not guilty of war crimes. He was a very good general. When Rommel was heading toward El Alamein, he did not want Rommel to head there. He told him, don't do it. And the reason why is because the British were sending convoys through the Mediterranean to Malta. They're able to get to Malta, and then they're able to supply Egypt. Well, you got Italy here, you got Libya here. What's happening? The Italian Air Force is bombing Malta. The German Air Force is bombing Malta. And General Bastia wants Rommel to land at Malta. You land at Malta, you take away the British supplies. Egypt's going to fall. And mind you, at this time, in order for the British to supply Egypt, they would have to sail all around Africa, come up the Red Sea, go through the Suez to get there. It would have been a huge, huge stretch for the British to be able to supply it. Mussolini actually had a very good general with a very good idea. The problem is, Rommel couldn't be told what to do. And Rommel, who was the German general in charge of the Africa Corps, was a very good general, but the problem is that he didn't tend to listen. He didn't listen at all. General Kesselring would tell him things, and he would make sure the static would scramble up on the radio so that he wouldn't hear his orders. And he didn't want to deal with General Bastia. As to be honest with you, Mussolini's generals did not get along with Rommel at all. Garibaldi couldn't stand Rommel. Hated his guts. And as a result, you have an ally who's very successful, but he's not working in concert with his men. What ends up happening? The British 8th Army under Montgomery wins at El Alamein. Rommel's troops start to retreat back. They're not able to stop the 8th Army. The North Africa campaign is very quickly coming to a close. As it comes to a close, Ernesto Bastia is recalled to Italy by Mussolini. He is not given another wartime assignment. While the 8th Army is driving, here, you have the Gaulle's Leclerc troops driving from Lake Chad. They're meeting in Tripoli. Actually, he attacked Fezzan and Kofra, and then he eventually drove all the way to Tripoli. So now, what happens? You have the army, the Italian army, retreating into Tunisia. This is where we get into the war. All this is taking place prior to us getting into the war. Surprisingly. Because what happens is, after Pearl Harbor, what's the first place where our troops get involved in? French North Africa. We land in Morocco. Mm-hmm. We're driving across Algeria. Kasserine Pass is right here. And what happens is Rommel is trying to stave off our troops at Kasserine Pass, and at the same time he's dealing with Montgomery coming in from here. Now, around this time, there were actually two attacks. We don't often hear about Kassar Rhino, which was basically what the French and British would call their Kasserine. He actually tried to drive into Libya and got beat. And then he tried to drive at Kasserine Pass and got beat. And they were trapped right here in this part of Tunisia. Rommel's called back. General Ettore Bastia is called back. The German commander now is general by the name of von Arnim. The Italian commander at that time is a guy by the name of General Nice. Very good commanders in a very bad situation. And what ends up happening is they end up surrendering at the Battle of Tunis. Over 400,000 soldiers are captured.
Captured
or killed. Mussolini takes a huge hit. Now, this is where it really starts to get interesting. Because look at all of the stuff that Mussolini had. Somalia, gone. Ethiopia, gone. Libya, gone. And even though we think about Hitler being a threat because he's bombing London during the Blitz, the thing is that Italy had a very good seagoing navy. If they could get past the Royal Navy in the Mediterranean and get past Gibraltar, if they got to the Atlantic Ocean, they would have caused havoc. Much more havoc than the German battleship Bismarck did. They never got there. Also in the 1930s, they had pilots that flew from Italy all the way to the East Coast here in America in sea boats. There was the threat of air raids here in America. one of those facts that are lost to the history books.
What stopped them from getting to Gibraltar?
The Royal Navy.
The Royal Navy.
The Royal Navy.
Is it submarines or?
Battleships.
Battleships.
They did an attack at Toronto Harbor. They sunk some of Mussolini's ships there.
Sure.
And then they also fought several battles like at Cape Matapan. And then the Italian Navy, after those two defeats, were very reluctant to be aggressive. They were basically more concerned with holding on to the region that they had. If they were aggressive, no telling what would have happened. And some of the and to some degree, I should mention that they did have submarine units here in Bordeaux, France. So you did have Italian subs in the Atlantic, U-boats. But you don't hear about it often. They did use U-boat activity and what they call frogmen, which were basically scuba divers mm-hmm. that could attach bombs on the bottom of ships. They were striking Egypt with those. They actually hit a British battleship in Alexandria Harbor. So they had the weapons and the training, but they weren't aggressive. If they were aggressive, and you'll see it later, you'll see just how aggressive they could have been, because there are a lot of things that could have happened. Not right after we ended up here in Tunisia, a lot of different things took place for Mussolini. Mussolini's 8th Army is fighting here in the Soviet Union. The commander of the 8th Army is the former head of the 10th Army in Libya, Italo Garibaldi. He's over there in the Soviet Union with Hungary, Romania, I think it's the Romanian 3rd and 4th Army, as well as troops from, of course, Germany, and even Spain further north. They put up a very good fight. And a lot of their successes in the Soviet Union were because General Garibaldi was asking General Mannheim, or Manstein, the German General Manstein, for the more difficult assignments. He wanted the difficult assignments. Even though he had mechanized units with tanks, he also was still using cavalry units. What happened with the 8th Army, unfortunately, was that Stalingrad mauled them even harder than the Germans did. The Germans lost the 6th Army, the Italians pretty much lost the 8th. Because when the Soviets drove into Stalingrad, they drove in from the flanks. And the 8th Army was caught directly in the attack. Very few soldiers from the 8th Army came back. Very, very, very few. Casualties were extremely high, and Mussolini was recalling them. At this time, Mussolini still had troops here, of course Albania, Croatia, southeast France, and now the Allies are coming out of Tunisia and they're landing in Sicily. Montgomery is on one side, General Patton is on the other side. And this is where it gets very interesting for Mussolini. Because now he loses power. So, this is 1943.
What year was that?
1943. We're in 1943 at this time.
Who uses power? You said
Mussolini loses power.
Oh, loses. Oh, I thought you said uses. I'm finished.
From what you've detected, and Mussolini was not a military expert, so his chief of staff and supporting staff appears to be, I don't want to say incompetent, but not of a mindset of protecting your territory. You know, in Tunisia, they should have been able to pull those folks back into Sicily because that was not much of a sea distance. and coordination with the Navy could have helped block the British from that attempt, or preventing them from that attempt. Whatever happened to that staff? Because weren't they also involved in what you're coming up to next?
Yes. Yes. They
were they not enamored with going into the war at all?
You could say that, partly. Mussolini suffered from two things. First, he suffered from the fact that he did not have the best equipment in his military. That was a huge, 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 huge problem. When the Allies landed, and actually prior to the Allies landing in Sicily, Mussolini knew things were bad. He knew it. I don't know. Just look at the map. So he puts General Rovella in charge of the Italian army. Now Rovella fought in the Spanish Civil War. General Rovella's fighting here in the Spanish Civil War. After the Spanish Civil War, General Rovella was moved to Croatia and Slovenia. He was very brutal, extremely brutal. Rovella killed tens of thousands of Yugoslav partisans. He just didn't care. He just did not care at all. He was so systematic with his brutality that even when they pulled him out, the people who were under him carried out his orders. It was very, 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 very tragic. Mussolini puts Rovella in because Mussolini understands the situation. The military either is not fighting or the military is not capable of fighting. It was actually a combination of the two. When we landed in Sicily, they had artillery right on the beach, in the sand. And what they would do is they would dig huge pits in the sand, basically pack them in with sandbags, and literally have the guns sitting right on the beach. Because they figured that as soon as the enemy would come, or the Allies would come in, they would meet them right on the coast to fight. Problem is, that's not good when you have high-range bombers. Bombers are going to just plaster your artillery. You know, their artillery was not in concrete bunkers to keep it safe or anything like that. So it was one of the situations was a total lack of planning. Another situation was that they had a lack of equipment. They didn't fight sometimes with the best commanders. The ground troops were far more brave than the high command. And that's what did Mussolini in. So when the Allies land in Sicily, General Rovella is being brutal against his own men at this point. Now, this is very, 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 very key. Because here's what ends up happening. King Victor Emmanuel III fires Mussolini, has him arrested. Because remember, Mussolini is not the head of the country like Hitler was. He has to answer to the king. The king is looking at the map and he's saying, you gave my empire up. You're out of here. Game's up. So now, Mussolini's arrested. General Badaglio is now the head of the Italian government. Marshal Badaglio was very competent. He was very elderly. Very elderly man, but very competent. He did not want to fight in Greece. He rather retired. He really didn't want to support Mussolini much at all. So now, he's in charge of the government. Now, here's the problem that's really interesting. You would think that if the Italian government is going to surrender, you will pull your troops back from Greece, from these islands in Greece, from Yugoslavia, pull them back to Italy and fortify your positions. If they pull back, fortify their positions, and then sign a treaty with the Allies or surrender, our troops could have landed in Italy and we wouldn't have been fighting. Because all of this territory, Germany would have had the fight to take. They didn't do it. There was the high command of the Italian army at that point under Mussolini, and even after Mussolini, they were not moving in a coordinated way. Just like they could have pulled out of Tunisia, they could have pulled out all of these areas, and they would have been justified to do it. The enemy is knocking at the gate of your country. You need to reinforce your troops at home. Pull your troops back. They didn't do it. And this becomes a problem, a huge problem, when Italy surrenders. A gigantic problem. Because Mussolini is arrested. King Victor Emmanuel III starts to negotiate terms of an armistice. The terms of the armistice are being negotiated by General Bastico. So you have an armistice being planned. The German military is unaware of it, or at least they seem unaware of it. And remember, Germany, Italy, and Japan were in a treaty. The Axis powers. Japan doesn't know about it. That's real, real big. And here's why. Remember how we talked about earlier how Italy was when Mussolini was young? They wanted to be a world power. Well, in the late 1900s, you had a lot of countries that were taking cities in China. Italy was one of them. Italy had a city in China. So when the Japanese move in, they don't bomb that city. Italy's our ally. We're going to leave them alone. Well, now, if Italy surrenders, you know what the Japanese are going to do. They're going to interrogate everybody. They're going to interrogate everybody. They're going to see what's happening. And they're going to basically say, do you support the king or do you support Mussolini? If you support the king, then they're going to watch you. Okay, in China. If you're an Italian citizen, they're going to watch you. However, if you support the king, you're arrested on the spot by the Japanese military. We don't often think about Mussolini having any effect in the Pacific at all, but he does. Now, the Italians surrender, okay? This gets ugly. Very, very ugly. They're surrendering. The Italian Navy sails to meet the British at Malta. The Germans turn on them. They begin to launch airstrikes against the Italian Navy. They actually sink the flagship, the battleship, the Rome. They use a missile called the X-Fritz. Has anyone ever heard of the X-Fritz? Has anyone ever heard of a cruise missile?
Yes.
The X-Fritz is the world's first cruise missile.
I hate to interrupt this because I have to leave. Okay. But I just wanted to tell you that we just finished reading a book in my book club called Under the Scarlet Sky by Mark Sullivan. Uh-huh. It's the end of the... It's when the Germans invade Italy and take over... This all takes place in Milan. And there is one man who's alive today, who at age 17 and 18 started rescuing Jewish families through the Alps, and he later becomes the driver for the general in charge of all of North Italy.
Ooh.
And he's a spy for the resistance, and you never hear anything about the resistance in Italy, the Italian resistance. So historians have said, as you started out saying, that this whole Italian history of World War II is vastly underrated,
yes.
not understood, and they call it the soft belly of World War II.
Yep.
So, read. It is a fast read, not the best written, but very good read. Under the Scarlet Sky, Beneath the Scarlet Sky by Mark Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And this guy still lives, the Italian man. He's a big skier and...
I'm
a race car driver.
Oh, wow. But that's actually I'm glad you said that because we're getting to that. The Germans attack the Italian Navy just north of Malta. They sink a huge battleship. Blows it up. When the Italians surrender, a guy by the name of General Castellano actually signs the surrender. Not General Battaglia. He's not coming to Malta to sign it. General Castellano does. When this takes place, the Germans are furious. They start attacking Italian troops on the Dodecanese Islands. Has anyone ever heard the movie Captain Corelli's Fighting Men? That's what that's about. That's exactly what that's about. That's taking place in the Dodecanese Islands. Because the German military is saying, we can't trust these guys. They're not going to keep fighting for us. We're not going to allow them to give these territories to the Allies. Wipe them out. They began to attack troops in Yugoslavia, in Greece. In some cases, they would tell the commanders of the Italian units, are you going to continue to fight with us or not? If the commander said yes, then you're pretty much going to live. If the commander says, I don't know, then run for the hills. Because it's going to get ugly. A lot of Italian soldiers joined the Yugoslav resistance under General Tito, or Marshal Tito. Those of us who were around in the 1960s and 70s remember Marshal Tito. But a lot of Italian soldiers joined him. A lot of Italian soldiers joined the Greek resistance. In Sardinia, the Germans had a hard time dealing with the Italian army because they were outnumbered in Sardinia. So what they ended up doing was retreating to Corsica, which was also under Italian occupation. The problem is that Corsica is a part of France. So what ends up happening? The resistance attacked the Germans in Corsica. Some of the Gauls' troops under Henri Girard joined the resistance. They actually do an amphibious landing in Corsica. And now you have French resistance, French combat troops, and former Italian combat troops that joined the French resistance, all attacking the Germans. And a lot of times what they did was the Germans just marched right up the coast and over to Elbe and eventually out. They couldn't cut off the retreat, the path of retreat, but they lost quite a lot of men. In this portion of Italy, many of these troops were allowed to just go home. The Germans under General Blaskowitz really didn't intend to attack them. They were probably the guys that came out the best here and in Sardinia. The U-boat units in Bordeaux, which were totally separated from everything else, were also allowed to continue. But you would think that they would have consolidated some type of plan before they surrendered. And when the Germans began to march in, like our friend just said, they came through Milan, they came through Florence, Genoa, and eventually they arrived in Rome. That was a very, very tough call because General, or he's actually a count, but he was a general as well. Calvi di Borgolo was in charge of the defense of Rome. King had him in charge of basically anything that happened in Rome. He did not want to leave Rome, and you can't blame him. That's his capital. He's willing to fight to defend the capital. The king orders him south. He doesn't want to go south. They literally have to kind of scold him to get him out of there. He pulls out. The Germans march in, ultimately under General Kesselring and General Vedinov. And eventually he drives south and meets the Allies in this portion of Italy, basically Calabria and around the end of the boot. This part of Italy, the Allies did not have to fight for. It was already under Italian hands when they landed, for the most part. They did have to fight at Salerno, which was just here. We had land in Salerno. But in Calabria, we did. And eventually, we also landed in Anzio further up the coast as well. But that's later on. Now, to give you some idea of how things begin to unfold, the Italian campaign literally takes one path, and Mussolini tends to take another path. Because he's no longer in power, he has very little effect on the campaign. I can basically sum up what happens in the campaign in about 2 minutes. Churchill wanted to go through Italy. He thought it was the soft underbelly of Europe. The commander of the Allied forces in the Mediterranean was a guy by the name of Sir Alexander, Harold Alexander. Under Harold Alexander, you had some Canadian units. You had General Anders of the Polish Army. You had General Juin of the French Army and Mark Wayne Clark of the United States Army. I believe Mark Wayne Clark was fifth. They marched up the boot of Italy. They fought several battles like at Cassino, San Pietro. They eventually do a landing at Anzio. They link up after very, very difficult problems with the bridgehead because the Germans were able to get reinforcements to surround the beachhead very effectively. But they eventually march. They take Rome on June the 5th and June the 6th, 1944. Unfortunately, something happens on June the 6th, 1944 that has nothing to do with Rome. D-Day. So it gets lost in history. Okay. They eventually march north, take Florence, take Siena, take Genoa, they cross the Po River, and very late in the war, they take Milan. The thing is that up until the fighting that takes place around Florence and Genoa, it has very little to do with Mussolini. Okay. What happens after Mussolini is arrested is that Adolf Hitler sends paratroopers to rescue him, directly under the command of General Kesselring. Kesselring is the overall German commander in Italy. He was an artillery man. He was a master in artillery, but he was also a pilot. Very good. Doggone good pilot. He sends an airborne rescue unit to get Mussolini out of the mountaintop jail, and he's carted off to Berlin. When Mussolini gets to Germany, he begins to found a new country called the Republic of Salo. Salo, S-A-L-O. It's basically the Socialist Republic of Italy. And they form in northern Italy. Basically everything, you could almost say everything north of Siena becomes this new country. Now, some people would obviously say that it's a puppet state because he isn't really able to manufacture a whole lot, and he's now taking a back seat to Hitler clearly by this point. But he had a lot of good troops, a very, very good amount of good troops, very dedicated amount of good troops. He had very good planes, very good fighter planes. Just about half of the Italian Air Force continues to fight under Mussolini in northern Italy. And he finishes the war basically fighting like that. He really has a tough time because he has to deal with the Italian partisans or the Italian resistance. And he also has to deal with the allies that are marching north. The problem, and this is where Count Cavi actually was rather correct, if they were successful and building a fortified line in northern Italy, they could have probably held out pretty well against Germany. The problem is that they never did it. And it shows that they would have been effective because they knew the terrain, and the resistance was very effective. There were times when the Italian resistance really caused quite a few casualties against the German units around Milan, around Torino, around Lake Como. They were quite a force to be reckoned with. And Mussolini also had to deal with them. As a matter of fact, they're the ones who did Mussolini in. The resistance killed them. They got to him. What ends up happening with Mussolini, and this is how the war comes to an end for him, is that the fighting takes place in 1944 and into 45. Now, remember June 6th, we talked about it. Allies are coming in from Normandy. Normandy begins to basically, I guess you could say, change the outlook of things. But what affects Mussolini also is that there's a landing in Provence. The landing in Provence does quite a few things. History books very, very seldom talk about this. General Patch drives north with General de Lattre de Tassigny, and eventually France is liberated, for the most part, by December 1944, with the exception of the Comar Pocket. Comar Pocket's not liberated until January, early February, which is up toward the German border. The thing is that now there are units right on the Franco-Italian border. So now you have Kesselring in Italy, General Bedinghoff in Italy, General Lanzinger in Italy, Mussolini is in Italy along with Marshal Graziano, and they're facing General Alexander to their south. They're facing, actually, this would be General Doyen. Can't think of General Doyen's first name. He was in charge of the Army of the Alps, French 27th. And by this time, you also have the Russians coming in, heading into Germany, fighting at Budapest, going into Romania, and then Romania switches sides. Bulgaria switches sides, goes into Yugoslavia, and then Tito's partisans are threatening Trieste and even Venice. So you can pretty much see that Mussolini is surrounded at the end of 1944. By the time you get into January and February of 45, our Allied troops are in Germany. French are here. American units are here. Patton's up here. They're meeting the Soviets. By this point in time, General Clark is heading toward Milan. General Alexander is heading toward Lake Como and Venice. French 27th take Aosta and Torino. Now he's trapped here. The noose is tightening. And I should also say that often we don't think about this, but there were other countries that were fighting, other than the big five countries, America, Britain, Russia, and France. You had a Brazilian military unit that was heading toward Genoa. So the Brazilians were under Clark marching along the coast. This is where Mussolini gets done at. Now, you had also some Italian units, because the Italian army that was loyal to the king was also fighting against Mussolini as well. So they were also marching north along with General Alexander and the British, mostly along the west. And Mussolini gets caught heading towards Switzerland by the Italian partisans. Him and his girlfriend, his mistress. Clara. And the stories vary as to how he dies. Probably the most popular story is that the resistance catch his motorcade. They make everybody get out. Something occurs that causes a dispute. And Clara starts yelling, basically saying, "You're not going to kill him. Kill Mussolini." She's defending her man. Partisans don't really care about this at this point. Their country's devastated. They've lost millions of people. So they shoot him in the stomach. And Mussolini, in a brave, brave act of heroism, always known for flashy uniforms, jumps out and starts yelling and screaming and ripping his shirt open. "Shoot me, shoot me, don't shoot her." And they gladly oblige. That's one of the stories, one of the many stories.
Can you repeat that last sentence?
Well, I was saying that he jumps out and
he's telling the resistance, don't shoot Clara, shoot me. Shoot me, and they shoot him. They gladly oblige and shoot him. He was killed by the Italian partisans. Dragged eventually. Actually, they didn't drag him. They put him in the truck. They took him to a gas station in Milan. Decided to beat his body pretty bad. And then they hung him up by his feet from the top of the gas the aperture that holds the gas hoses. So, yeah, this was in Milan. They hung him upside down. Him, Clara, and I think two other of his leaders were hung up there upside down. And then eventually he got cut down, and then the crowd started spitting on him and beating him again. You know, to the point where you could barely recognize the body. But, upside down, he's hanging by his feet like a piece of beef. That's basically what they did. They hung him like a piece of beef in the butcher shop. This plays a role, of course, for Hitler, because this is one reason why when Hitler's in Berlin, he shoots himself. Hitler's saying, I'm not going out like that. You know, so he's in the bunker. And Mussolini only dies a few days prior to Hitler. It's early May 1945. So what does Hitler do? He's hiding in the bunker. He's like, I guess I gotta make it right with the girl. So he marries Eva Braun because he's been shacking up with her I don't know how long. He decides to do something right in his life. he marries her and then decides to take cyanide, and I guess he knows the cyanide's not gonna work fast enough, so he shoots himself. He's not gonna let the people catch him alive. Like they did Mussolini. General Graziani, Rodolfo Graziani, actually signs the surrender as for the Republic of Salo. Because by that time, you also had Royal Italian troops fighting on the Allied side. So he surrendered to his own countrymen, as well as to the British and Americans and everyone else. But, yeah, Mussolini's totally out the way. Totally out the way.
Whatever happened to his family?
They're still around.
The family, I'm sorry.
They're still around. He has a granddaughter that's in the Italian Senate. Not family.
No. What happened to his wife? No, his wife? Wait a minute.
Which wife?
His mistress was the one that you were talking about, right?
Yeah. His wife survived the war.
Did his wife divorce?
Well, she didn't have to divorce him.
Okay. So okay.
Yeah. She survived the war.
She
lasted. I think she died in the early 60s.
Okay.
And his children were around. He lost a son during World War II. His oldest boy. I think he had three children that survived. One, I know his daughter. Now, this is very, very interesting, too. His daughter was married to Galeazzo Chiani, who was his foreign minister. If you ever see photos of the signing of the Pact of Steel, you'll see Hitler signing, you'll see the Japanese ambassador signing, and you'll see a young man in an Italian uniform. That's Galeazzo Chiani. He was also, in 1940, he was in charge of the units trying to break through the Alpine in France, not successfully. But he was a pretty interesting guy. Flashy suits, tall, you know, very rather dashing person. He kind of reminds you a bit of, if you ever see pictures of him outside his military uniform, you would not think of him as a foreign minister. Galeazzo Chiani was more like a person who you would see hanging out on a movie set. Very dashing. There were rumors that the lady who Edward VIII was eventually to marry, Lala Simpson, was also tied to him. She may have had relationships with him prior to marrying Edward VIII. That was a very, very hot rumor at the time. The thing about Galeazzo Chiano was that when King Victor Emmanuel III had Mussolini arrested, well, what does he do? Is he going to be loyal to Mussolini? No. He's not getting arrested. So what does he do? He claims loyalty to the king. Well, that becomes a problem when the Germans get Mussolini out. Because Mussolini's going to try to kill his son-in-law. I mean, it's bad enough when you're the son-in-law. You know, let's be honest. If you're the son-in-law, you don't want to get your dad mad. You know? And if your dad's the dictator, you really don't want to get him mad. And that's what Galeazzo Chiano does. He manages to get Mussolini mad because now when Mussolini's free, it's kind of known that he helped overthrow Mussolini, or at least that's how it looks. So he gets arrested, and Mussolini puts him on trial. Now, mind you, this is the man that's married to Mussolini's daughter. So he gets put on trial. I think they're put on trial in Milan, because Milan actually becomes the de facto capital of the Republic of Salo, because the Allies had taken Rome. They put him on trial, and they sentence him to death by firing squad. But Mussolini does something kind of... he's Mussolini. You kind of know how he's going to do things. He's going to be dramatic. So he doesn't make Galeazzo Chiano get tied to a stake. He's not going to hang him like a criminal. He's going to face a firing squad. He's going to... And at that time, just so that you know, if you were going to be hung, that was a criminal's execution. If you were going to be executed by a firing squad, that was kind of seen as being honorable. I don't know how, but it was kind of seen as being honorable.
It was quicker,
and you weren't dangling and choking, and your eyes weren't rolling in your head and all of that. But they tended to show some dignity with it. This is one reason why after the Nuremberg trials, many of the head Nazis like Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel was not shot by a firing squad. That would have been seen as an honor. They hung him. Many of the chief Nazis that were executed after Nuremberg were hung. If they didn't commit suicide on sideline, you know, like Himmler and Göring, that tended to be what they would do. So what happens? He's going to have Galeazzo Chiano shot. But he doesn't make him stand in front of a crowd. He ties him to a chair and faces the chair away from the gunman so Galeazzo Chiano can't see the people who are shooting him and can't make a raving speech or something like that. So he tries to whittle away on how he's going to execute the guy. And what happens? He totally forgets that Galeazzo Chiano is in the military, and he knows how to tie knots, and he knows how to untie knots, because if he's captured by the Allies, he has to get out and get away. So what does Galeazzo Chiano do? He's sitting in the chair trying to get away while they're ready to shoot him, and he manages to get free. So he gets free. It's not funny, but you kind of have to wonder how these things play out. He gets free, unties himself, gets out the chair, and starts yelling at the soldiers. And the soldiers shoot him, and they finally execute him. But it's really, really, really comical how this all plays out. You would never think it. But he does have three children, I think, that survive. I know his daughter survived. Her husband. Galeazzo Chiano's wife did survive. And he has a grandchild who's in the government now. Calls quite a stir.
Another question. During the political events that led to the war and during the war, etc., the final solution, Italy did not send a lot of its Jewish and Gypsy population to Germany.
That's true.
And it's not that Mussolini was moral in any effects, but and his father being anti-cleric, I just found that to be somewhat strange.
Well, Mussolini, it is quite strange, but Mussolini did not have a problem with Jews. He didn't have a problem with gypsies. He wasn't terribly fond of Africans, but partly that's because Ethiopia defeated them at Alba. He thought, and this comes out many years after the war, when his diary is found in the 1990s, he did not understand Hitler's strange fascination for annihilating the Jews. He totally didn't understand it. He didn't want any Jews deported. A lot, and he was not alone. You know, a lot of Axis countries were kind of wondering what was going on with that. Bulgaria didn't deport him. Romania had a tough time resisting deporting him, but some of their leaders weren't fond of that. Mussolini definitely didn't understand it. And that's actually one of the problems, because when he's overthrown, a lot of the Jews in Italy believed that nothing would happen to them because the Catholic Church was there and the Italian population did not support the anti-Semitic policies, and even Mussolini did. And it turns out that they couldn't have been further from the truth. When Hitler got in there, he starts deporting them. The Jewish population in Venice, the Jewish population in Milan suffered. But up until more Venice than Milan. Because even then, at the end, Mussolini did not deport many people out of Milan, because that was his de facto capital. Mm-hmm. That was something that comes from the idea of a master race that the Nazis believed in. What they did was they would literally take the closest thing that I can describe it to is they were taking evolution and mythology and grouping it together to believe that certain races were superior to others or more evolved. And they really ran with it. Where Mussolini didn't really care. Mussolini's like, listen, I'm in charge. As long as I'm in control, I don't care what you guys do. Just pay my taxes and we'll be fine. And Mussolini, being a student of history, also knew that the Roman Empire did have a Jewish population in Rome. Mm-hmm. So he didn't have a problem.
Well, also, a lot of the Jews had Italian names. He considered them people Italian first and Jews second. That's the way they see them. And there's a movie called The Garden of the Pizzicantinis about Jews. And a lot of them had Italian names. So that was like Pizzicantinis or Villanellos, and they were like that. So they considered those Jews Italians first, Jews second, and they were part of, you're exactly right. In fact, when Mussolini kind of lost a lot of respect from a lot of the Italians when he capitulated to Hitler and started to get into that, but they considered them part of the Italian things. And again, it all worked against them, but a lot of them had Italian names. Had married, and a lot of Jews, when they saw what was going on there, adopted their Italian names or made sure that they had the Italian names to kind of avoid that. And they kind of, said, well, it's not going to happen here, but that kind of thing was, it was a totally different thing.
And when you think about it, you have a Jewish population in Rome, okay, dating back to the time of Emperor Claudius. Matter of fact, the Arch of Titus actually has things from Jerusalem during the first Roman-Jewish war in the year 70. If anyone knows about the Bible, there was a Jewish temple in Jerusalem that General Titus destroyed in the year 70. Okay. But you have a Jewish population in Rome earlier than that. So you did have a lot of Jews in Rome and throughout Italy with Italian. And it would have made it rather difficult for the Germans to do much. Plus, to be honest, they didn't have that much time. I mean, from 1943 to 45, That's the only time that they were in Italy with any full strength. So, time was also a good factor. And this brings up another interesting point. Mussolini, this comes out of his diaries that were discovered, entries in the diaries that were discovered. It seems that he did not have a totally good image of Hitler. He kind of thought he was a little bit crazy. And he saw himself somewhat as a person that may have been able to buffer some of his ideas. Now, how much of that is legitimate, or to what degree he meant that by, only he knew. But he wasn't all that, you know, trusting. But then again, why wouldn't he be? You know, if you look at the life of Mussolini, World War I, who were they fighting against? Austria and Germany. So you're not going to be too quick to trust the people that try to attack you and then 20 years later act like you're their best friend. More or less circumstances dictated what he did, and the fact that he was opportunist, total opportunist.
Another question for you, going back to the 1930s. Mm-hmm. We have Somaliland, we have Ethiopia, we have Libya. None of those geographic areas are known to provide a lot of or earth or war material or economic benefit.
Yes.
Why?
Well, with Libya, this really does predate Mussolini to a degree. Because he was alive when they took over Libya, but he was maybe 30? Matter of fact, I think he was still an editor at the Socialist newspaper when they took over Libya. They might have oil in southern Libya, but at that time it was really not all that accessible. And it was more of a combination of imperialist ambition and opportunity. In the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire was known as the sick man of Europe. See, there was a time when the Ottoman Empire controlled Libya, Ethiopia, all of that. When the British took Egypt, Libya was a province that was cut off from them. And they had a hard time holding on to that. Now, they still had this area, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, what's now Israel, Jordan, Syria, because that was not carved out until after World War I in Lawrence of Arabia. Becomes very famous for that. But this here, they had a very hard time holding on to, especially because the Turkish Navy was not great at all. So the Italian royal government basically was able to say, okay, this is a territory that we can free. They're not able to really hold on to this, so we're going to take it. Mm-hmm. And at that time, in 1911, 1912, you also had a lot of problems going on with Bulgaria and the Ottoman Empire as well. Because, and we don't often get much into this, but prior to World War I, Bulgaria actually went down to the Aegean. They had a corridor here that connected them to the coast. One of the reasons for this is because Bulgaria was a country that became independent with Russian help, and they were an Orthodox Christian country. The Ottoman Empire was Islamic. And what they wanted to do was to retake Constantinople. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty close to doing it. In 1911 and 1912, they were rather close to doing it. This is why you have this part of Turkey that's here, but it's a very small part. The Bulgarians were pushing towards that wish. So the Ottoman Empire was in no condition at all to hold on to Libya. Italy said, we want an empire, ancient Rome controlled Libya, let's take it. As far as Ethiopia is concerned, they had Somalia, they had really Eritrea, which is the coast of Ethiopia, right here. They got Eritrea by a treaty between Ethiopia and Italy. The French had Djibouti, actually, up until 74. They still have troops stationed there to this day. We have a huge base, gigantic base. We have a base there. The Chinese even have a base there now.
Everybody.
What's the source of economic? I mean, they need it.
But the French still have a base there.
Yeah.
But it controls the entrance.
Mm-hmm. The Red Sea.
Yeah.
But they wanted, under Mussolini's time, they wanted Ethiopia more out of revenge for the Battle of Alba.
Yeah. But moving back to Mussolini, certainly what I got from Corelli's Mandolin, mm-hmm. and also what sometimes is getting mentioned now, mm-hmm. is Mussolini's personality. And of course, this is again is the victors looking at the person who defeated. So I don't know how much of that is accurate. That you know, as a child, he was punished for being a bully. He certainly had a whole lot of interest in lots of different women, and he was very comic in reaching out to the people that he spoke to in terms of reaching things that he really wasn't going to do. And I have no idea if that's an accurate representation of him or not.
No, I think it's fairly accurate. He cheated on his wife quite a bit. He was a womanizer. Well, but that's kind of obvious when you get shot with the mistress. I mean, he was a womanizer.
Can't talk yourself out of that.
And he was, he really was a good speaker, very dynamic speaker. Rather boastful at times, rather pompous. But he was a good speaker. I think with him, well. I'm not sure if I would call. I mean, you could say he was a bully, but I wouldn't really be sure I would call him that. But a good speaker and a womanizer, yes. He was that.
And there was this also story presented, again, I don't know its accuracy, that the commander-in-chief of his army was not even told that the troops in Albania were going to invade Greece, and that the ambassador in Athens, the Italian ambassador in Athens, didn't know what was going to happen either. That Mussolini just kind of decided to do it.
Very few people knew about it. Mm. Matter of fact, very few people, that was with Albania invading Greece, but very few people even knew that he was going to invade Albania when he did. That was a spur of the moment thing. Marshal Battaglia did know about it. Mm. Now, that he knew about. Mm. And he was in charge of the army. He wasn't happy about it. He went against it rather vocally in the Italian army, and Mussolini overruled him. And I think that with that was probably the final nail in the coffin for him working with Mussolini. They butted heads a lot. Marshal Battaglia was not fond of the alliance with Hitler. He was not fine with a war with Britain and France. He was not fine with the attack on Greece. Now, the generals on the ground may have not known, but Battaglia knew. And Greece definitely didn't know. Greece didn't know. I know General Metaxas was the dictator in Greece at the time. And the Greek army general, it was either Pedalius or something like that. I know his name began with a B. I mean, a P. I'm not sure what he knew. I'm really not sure. I know that Metaxas didn't seem to know. Or at least he gave no indication. And it was kind of sad, too, because the attack, even when the attack took place, the Greek military did not seem to throw their whole weight, which was scary for Mussolini. The ground troops were able to beat the initial attack back and actually fight their way into Albania. But the reason why I say that they didn't throw their whole weight in it was because the United States sold the Greek government two battleships, World War I battleships. They sold them to General Metaxas. General Metaxas actually had them in port the entire time of the attack that Mussolini did. They were eventually sunk at the docks when the Germans jumped into the fight. And they were sunk literally in the harbor. And one should wonder why. You would think General Metaxas would have ordered his fleet to at least mobilize, get out of the harbor, and just sail around. He may not have had a fighting chance against Mussolini's navy, but you don't sit in the harbor so that you can get plucked off. It's pretty interesting.
John, as I asked before, what about why did Mussolini and the Mafia? Why did he hate the Mafia? Asked you that before and said he loved it.
He hated the Mafia. He hated the Mafia. Mussolini hated them. What time is it?
10:01.
Okay, well, be free to leave if you wish, because it's definitely over. But if you wish to stay and ask questions, then you can.
I want to hear this.
All right. He hated the Mafia because the Mafia basically had a lot of control in Sicily. In southern Italy, and Mussolini was a control freak. Which is one reason why Mussolini didn't like Rommel. Mussolini wanted to control every aspect of everything he could. He wasn't big on Rommel because he couldn't control Rommel, and he hated the Mafia because the Mafia could buy a lot of local officials off and he couldn't consolidate power easily with them. He killed a lot of mob members in Sicily, executed a lot of them. So much so that when the Allies began to go into Sicily, it was decided that they were going to work, the American military was going to work with the mob. And Lucky Luciano. Yep. And things like that. So it's kind of funny when you think about it, how the government cracked down on the Italian mob here.
Yeah.
But when the war broke out, they actually used the Italian mob to get rid of Mussolini.
Yeah.
They worked quite hard, you know, to do that, and justifiably so. The mob in Sicily know the lay of the land very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's their home territory. You work with them, you basically know where things are located, where artillery positions are, where airfields are, so you know what to hit.
I think the mob expected some cred out here. Hey.
Be back.
Yeah. Hey.
But Mussolini hated them. Any more questions or statements for Mussolini?
Fantastic.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.